For the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. El Camino Real de Tierra Dentro, the Royal Road to the Interior, extends from Mexico City to the San Juan Pueblo in northern New Mexico. It joins the Rio Grande at El Paso, Texas, and except for the 90-mile trek across the Jornada del Muerto, it runs adjacent to the Rio Grande, whose headwaters spring out of the San Juan Mountains near what is now Creed, Colorado. Nearly 40 years ago, Carl Kernberger, my late friend and business partner in the Four Brothers Adventure Company, and I traveled the entire length of El Camino Real. Traveling the Camino Real in the mid-20th century was considerably safer than in earlier centuries when many of the Indian tribes took great umbrage at the presence of the descendants of the conquistadores. Here, historian Mark Simmons tells of some of the travails visited upon the caravans along the Camino.
The Navajos became a danger in the 19th century as well as the Apaches, but generally it was the southern Apaches who raided the caravans, and that's the reason they travel in such large caravans or convoys, just like the Spanish convoys, the flotillas in the Caribbean, the treasure flotillas. They'd all band together for protection and go once a year at a particular time. And the very same thing prevailed here in New Mexico with those wagon trains. People who had business and even the mail going out would wait until the time for the annual caravan to depart from upper New Mexico and go down south. Travelers would wait to take advantage of the protection. I'm sure there were cases of individuals who decided to risk their necks and go in a small party, but that was extremely dangerous. And they knew it, and sometimes they got through. Often they did, but often they didn't either. There was really a military organization from prior to the Pueblo Revolt, a person with military rank in charge. There were persons listed as soldiers who may have also been merchants, but who were responsible for the protection of the caravan as they moved south. The mere size of the caravan was protection itself. And in the later colonial period, you had soldiers from the Royal Presidio in Santa Fe sent out under a sergeant, sometimes under a lieutenant, who was in charge of the military escort. And those wagon caravans were huge. They had a huge body of livestock. It's rather interesting to me that the Spaniards always put their livestock in front of the wagon train to keep stragglers moving. Later American caravans, when they came over the Santa Fe Trail, always put their livestock in the rear. So they had a tendency for the livestock to start straggling back and even break away from the wagons. And the Indians would swoop down on those American caravans and drive off the livestock. The Americans didn't want to breathe the dust being behind their livestock.
Archaeologist John Roney has spent many years following the ancient tracks carved into the landscape and exploring the parajes or campsites along the Camino Real.
The areas on the fringes of the Spanish settlement are where the most hostile and most dangerous Indians were, because they were developing enmity toward the Spanish and at the same time acquiring horses and weapons and tactics that made them more effective adversaries, and were also probably being displaced from the ways that they used to make a living before the Spaniards came. Early on, you know, in the south, the Tepehuanes were a pretty serious problem. And then later in New Mexico, the Apaches, after the initial entradas into New Mexico, the Pueblo Indians seemed fairly peaceful, but as we know, in 1680, they rose up and really surprised the Spanish. And in fact, the Apaches joined the Pueblo Indians in that revolt, and they killed a large number of the Spanish colonists in New Mexico and forced the others back to El Paso for a period of about 12 years. While they were in the El Paso area then, Indians in that area revolted. The Suma and Janos and Jocome and Mansos, the groups that lived in that area, became a serious problem. Tobosos lived out in the Bolson de Mampimi. Those were hunter-gatherers, and as they began to acquire horses, they also became a pretty serious threat.
Franciscan missionaries were establishing missions throughout the region of the northern Rio Grande, pitting Christendom against the local deities of the Puebloans. Francis Levine is the director of the Palace of the Governor's History Museum.
I think at Gran Quivira, when you see the remains of San Buenaventura, the church that was never completed, it was started in the 1670s at a time when it must have been painfully obvious to the missionaries that they didn't have the support of the communities. Kachina dances were coming back stronger and stronger. There were raids on the community. There was a drought setting upon them. And this community was marginal in terms of its water supply. It was always strained for water. And why, at that particular moment, at the end of the 1660s, when the community is undergoing enormous stress, why the priest chose to start to build a new church, much larger than the church that was already there. But then I look at, you know, Ramon Gutierrez argues that the revitalization of the Cochinas, the desperation, both of the Pueblos and of the Christian missionaries, is what brought about the Pueblo Revolt. That it was this ideological conflict. When the priests knew that they weren't going to win, it just built and built and built so that they expanded their pressure to convert even while they were losing ground. And their own martyrdom was what they were seeking. It's a very controversial idea, but when you're at a place like Ranquivira, I grasp for any other explanation of what was happening.
Herman Aguayo from the San Juan Pueblo and Jose Aveta from the Isleta Pueblo talk about Indian beliefs.
One thing that keeps coming out is the fact that they were so tied to the land, very strong in their beliefs. Up to that point, the legends and the prophecies were still very strong, and so they were able to connect themselves to their roots and to their whole belief system.
They had religion about how to make it rain, you know, and some had religion about how to make things grow. Some had religion about how to plant, and some had religion about after they harvest, Thanksgiving. Oh, even now, all the Indians, they have respect for the earth. Now, we have the Indians have two religions here. Some are Catholic, that which is all right, and then we have our own religion. But the Indians, they believe in what they see. They believe in the sun. They see it with their own eyes, and they believe because they give us light. They warm the earth, which make the things grow. That's where they have their belief. And then they believe in the clouds. They see the clouds because it makes it rain, it makes things grow. And they see the rainbow. That's where they believe too. And they see the ground. They have the belief in the ground because that's where everything's grown. See, they believe on everything what they see with their eyes. And Catholic religion is good, but we talk about Jesus, but we don't know who he is. We see the picture, I don't know if that's the way he looks. But us Indians, we believe in what we see. I have my belief in the sun because that's the way my grandfather and my grandmother, they taught us. Well, Catholic is all right. I'm not against Catholic because I'm a Catholic. But we have respect for the earth because that's where everything grows, and we feed and we eat out of there. And we have very much respect for the earth. And the sun gives us light and everything every day. And the rain, we see it when it comes down. That's everything that we see, with our, we believe in our Indian way.
I think they were ardent believers of the Pueblo way of life and had very strong opinions and feelings. And probably as a result of that, whenever people couldn't resolve their differences, they just kind of packed up and maybe moved away and continued to be strong believers of how things should be. I think as a result of that strong belief, they were forced to stand up for their way of life, which resulted in the Pueblo Revolt. Hey, 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 hey.
In 1680, an enclave of Puebloan Indians, under the leadership of a San Juan Indian by the name of Pope, organized the Great Pueblo Revolt, the first successful revolution by indigenous people against invading colonists to be carried out on North American soil. An ingenious plan was devised whereby Indian runners would scatter through the Indian world of the Southwest, bearing the news of the intention of revolting against the Spanish, each carrying an identically knotted cord. Every day, a single knot was untied. The day came when the final knot was untied, marking the moment when all Indians throughout the land would rid their homeland of the Spanish. Hundreds of Spanish were killed. Many priests were martyred. Survivors straggled south along the Camino Real to El Paso. For a while, at least, the Indians had their homeland solely to themselves. Author E. A. Tonimares recites his well-known poem entitled, My Name is Pope.
My name was ripe with summer, a cornucopia overflowing with food for the pueblos. My name was the summer gathering together the life-giving maize, the plentiful squash, beans, and chili to feed the people of Oke-Owinji and all the pueblos of our land. As a child, I ran along the banks of the Rio Grande and nibbled the sweet grass that grew there, the blue grama, the little blue stem, chamomile, and the sunflowers. As a child, I learned the Tewa stories. We came from beneath the Sandy Place Lake. Our first mother was Blue Corn Woman, the Summer Mother, and our first mother was White Corn Maiden, the Winter Mother. All is sacred in our world, Shimmering Mountain to the north, Obsidian-Covered Mountain to the west, Turtle Mountain to the south, Stone Man Mountain to the east. All the hills are sacred, all the shrines are sacred, all the plazas are sacred, all the dances are sacred, all the directions and their colors, all are sacred for the pueblo, the Spaniards called San Juan. The Spaniards said our spirits were devils, their faith, the one true faith. In the name of God, they destroyed our kivas. In the name of God, they burned our cachinas. In the name of God, they forbade our dances. In the name of God, they flogged our caciques. When they took our Tewa names away, our mouths filled with the dust of our loss. As a young man, I knew the colors of life. I followed blue to the north, and my authority returned to me. I followed red to the south, yellow to the west, white to the east, and my authority returned to me. I visited the sacred hills and mountains. I knew the summer people. I knew the winter people. I knew my own name. My authority returned to me. Then the Spaniards took me. They flogged me. They could not take away my name. My authority returned to me. At Taos Pueblo, inside the Kiva, I invoked Bose Yemo, he who scatters the mist before him, and my authority returned to me. And then the war leaders came, and I spoke with authority. I sent forth the runners, bearing the knotted cords, to the 24 pueblos, to the 6 different languages, to all the directions and their colors, from Taos to the Hopi villages. When the time came, and the last knot unraveled, we struck everywhere at once. We raked a fire across the sun. We let those Spaniards go who had lived with us in peace. We drove the rest away. We let them go. When they returned with an army marching north to Santa Fe, I called upon Pose Yemu, he who scatters the mist before him. And the Rio Grande rose, breaking the marching ranks of soldiers, scattering the Spaniards into the mist along the river. We broke their arrogance like bits of dry straw. We drove them away. We let them go. The Spaniards came back, and after a long time, many of them became our compadres, our comadres. Then all the others came. We still endure. We shine with the brilliance of stars, within and around the earth, within and around the hills, within and around the mountains. My authority flows like the waters through the Pueblo lands. I know my own name. I know my own name. I know my own name.
As surviving Spanish fled southward carrying only the most meager supplies, some died, especially through the Jornada del Muerto. Author T. Diana Rebolledo speaks of Spanish women desperately attempting to escape to El Paso.
The Hispanic women were living in Santa Fe and also in small communities along the river when the Pueblo Revolt happened in 1680, and many of them were killed. Some of them were taken captives, actually, and the rest who survived walked all the way from Santa Fe to El Paso, sometimes just carrying their children and taking whatever few things they could take. It was a very, very difficult journey for them. There were real stories of people finding women dead, with their children at their breasts. There were a lot of stories about that. Some of the women were taken prisoner. When the Mexicans came back 12 years later, you know, they found some of the women were still there with new children and new husbands and new lives, and some of these people were recovered and some of them weren't.
Spanish historical documents indicate that the Spanish were willingly accompanied to El Paso by a group of Indians from the Isleta Pueblo, who then founded their own pueblo near El Paso, known as Isleta del Sur. El Paso historian George Torok speaks of the controversy over this issue.
Some of the Tigua believe that they were forcibly brought south by the Spanish, maybe used as a shield, as security, and that they were essentially enslaved once they were brought here. They were put to work for the Spanish, and that they had planned at some point in the future on returning to the north. The other theory is that these were friendly Indians, that these were Indians that were very comfortable with Spanish rule, that they didn't want anything to do with the revolt. They were loyal Catholics, and when the opportunity came to leave the area, they willingly went with the Spanish and willingly reestablished a settlement in the south. The third theory is just a more practical theory, that maybe they were just fleeing the fighting, that they weren't necessarily forced to come south, and they weren't willing to come south. They just wanted to get away from the warfare that was taking place. And to this day, that is a active controversy in the Tigua community as to exactly how the Tiguas arrived here. Were they forced or were they coming willingly?
Isleta del Sur war chief Rick Quesadas is adamant about the cultural recollection of his people concerning their ancestors' march to El Paso del Norte during the Pueblo Revolt of 1680.
Contrary to belief that we sided with the Spanish, we didn't side with the Spanish. Thought we were caught between, you know, crossfire, and the Spanish used us as hostages for negotiating with the other pueblos, and they brought us down here. We've been here since 1680. We established this church up here in Isleta, and we've been practicing our religion and our culture ever since. So we've been down here. My great-grandmother used to say that there were chants that were sung on their way down. They were singing in our language. Eventually, they were going to get revenge for what the Spanish had done to them. Eventually, they settled down here and then established the village, and we just kind of stayed here. We liked it. The surroundings were familiar to Isleta up there in the north, so we adapted to the area. We stayed here. We brought our religious artifacts. We have a drum we brought down there. We still use it for our feast days, some Kachina masks, and we still hold the original canes that were given to all the pueblos by the Spanish. We still have those. And we just kind of adapted to the area, and we've been here since that time.
In 1692, newly appointed Governor General of New Mexico, Don Diego de Vargas Zapata y Luján Ponce de León y Contreras, more commonly known as Don Diego de Vargas, headed north with a column of soldiers intent on reclaiming New Mexico for the Spanish crown. De Vargas was himself a soldier and capable, though pious, administrator. He was also rich enough to pay for the reconquest out of his own pocket. He entered Santa Fe in September 1692 and, through courage and the art of persuasion, was able to claim a bloodless victory, at least for the time being. Later, after shepherding hundreds of colonists back into northern New Mexico, he engaged in bloody battles that resulted in the death and enslavement of many Indians. For this, he was arrested and imprisoned, but subsequently acquitted and appointed for yet a second term as Governor General. As the story goes, De Vargas reconquered New Mexico with the divine aid of La Conquistadora, whose small statue of the Virgin Mary still resides in the St. Francis Cathedral in Santa Fe. Author Carmela Padilla recalls the importance of La Conquistadora.
She was brought along the Camino Real from El Paso, which is where the settlers had fled or were exiled after the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. As I learned about La Conquistadora as a child, of course, I learned about her truly in her mythic sense. how she was the icon who Don Diego de Vargas brought to accompany him back to Santa Fe in trying to make his reconquest of the region after the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. The mythical history that I learned that she came back and she helped him to reconquer the area and helped him most of all to avoid bloodshed in the reconquest. I, of course, learned that La Conquistadora was the icon he brought back, but of course the reconquest was not bloodless. She was still, though, tied up in my romantic kind of childhood mythology of Santa Fe, of this beautiful virgin who protected an entire people who wanted to come back to this area so much. They were so passionate about this place because of the landscape and because of the beauty and the faith that the Sangre de Cristo Mountains represented, that this whole mythology was created around her. I still associate La Conquistadora very much with that romantic image I have in my head of the early fiestas when I was a child and watching her being paraded through the streets during the processions and watching my mother going and walking the processions every year. No matter what kind of historical inaccuracies there may be, there's still this stringent faith that she represents, and is a faith that was carried from the settlers who first brought her here to the faith of the people who still worship her today.
Gregorita Rodriguez spent most of her long life in Santa Fe, following the traditional customs of her people. She became well known as a curandera, or traditional healer, throughout the region.
And we came to the processions because we had a devotion to the procession, the Corpus Christi procession, and the entrance of the Vargas, and then the Conquistadora, you know. We used to sing a lot of songs. I remember the one that says, O Virgen Conquistadora, Patrona de Santa Fe, te veres la gran señora, con devoción te rezaré.
After the reconquest and recolonizing of New Mexico, El Camino Real de Tierra Adentro remained the link between the colonists and their neighbors hundreds of miles to the south. Formerly known as San Bartolomé, the present-day town of Valle de Allende in Chihuahua, Mexico, was an important site on the Camino. All the caravans and all the people who were intending to head north to Santa Fe and beyond were required to go through a rigorous inspection there. Jesus Chu Herrera was born in El Valle and recollects some of the history of his community.
The transportation was ruled by the crown so bad, so tough, that if you stop here and if you go up north, if you didn't carry with you a gun or something like that, they don't let you out. If you didn't have enough fat, according to the rules, to get this carromato to certain area, you didn't leave the area. You have to have so many chickens because they were used by the priest for remedies. There was a whole bunch of rules and regulations that you must follow, or you don't go, you stay. And then there was another thing. They checked the travelers for illness here. Anyway, there was aduana. Not only means the goods, whatever, health too. They didn't have the means to cure them, but at least they, you know, this person can go. Or the child is almost pregnant, you can go. So they spent days and days here checking the cargo and checking the person and verifying that the person is whatever you say you are. Basically, they didn't allow single people to cross. They had to have a very special reason to let some person single to cross this area to go to New Mexico. I don't know, they figure they're going to invite your wife or whatever or look at her or something. But the rules were pretty strict. And if some of the people from El Valle wanted to go to New Mexico, I had to explain why. You had to explain your reason to leave this area and go to Paso del Norte or New Mexico, whatever. It was one. Like I said, the crowd was very tough.
El Valle de Allende remains a beautiful town. Here it is celebrated in the Paso Doble de Valle de Allende, performed by Victor Chaparro Delgado.
63 y recuerdo, según las historias rezan, la fundación de este pueblo. Era un santo misionero, misionero franciscano, piedad traía en el alma y en las manos su rosario. Don Agustín Rodríguez, de feliz memoria, es el héroe de esta historia. Sale un día de Zacatecas, rumbo a la Nueva Vizcaya, las penas en su camino le fortalecían el alma. Puso la primera piedra de este pueblo y por su fe quiso darle por patrono al Santo Bartolomé. Y sus manzanas, sus corrientes de agua clara, le dan la vida lozana. Son sus mujeres alegres, bellas hijas de Chihuahua, por sus venas corre sangre de la España milenaria. Han pasado los siglos y en mi viejo pueblo aún palpita su recuerdo. Por el trazo de sus calles se advierte la antigüedad. En su parroquia y santuario también su viejo portal. Es la Virgen del Rosario, patrón en la actualidad. Es la madre cariñosa que a todos tiene piedad.
The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. This segment is funded by a grant from the United States Bureau of Land Management with the ongoing support of the Ford Foundation. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.